Looking back at the early 1800s, it almost seems as if ancient monsters were ready to break out of the earth and into the limelight. Elephant bones in the Americas, marine reptile skulls deep underground, flying reptiles on the English coasts. With all of these strange creatures surfacing left and right, science and scripture were caught in a tug of war. But things got even messier when giant land lizards began springing up as well. How did we get to dinosaurs? Two legs, long tail, three-fingered hands, sharp teeth? How did the first people to encounter dinosaur bones figure out what they ought to look like? Well, they started by getting it completely wrong. I'm Emery Coolcats. Welcome to Season 2 of Museum of Natural Mystery. Today's topic might seem like it should have come up by now. What was the first dinosaur to be called a dinosaur? Of course, as is always the way with natural history, it's not so simple. And you might be surprised by how many of the individual topics we've previously discussed on this podcast that had to come together to get us to where we are today. Our story begins with a gigantic broken femur found in the Stonesfield Quarry in Oxfordshire, England in 1676. Robert Plott, a chemistry professor at Oxford and then curator of the Ashmolean Museum, examined the femur and deduced that it must be the remains of a Roman war elephant, which wasn't too far-fetched to guess. We've talked about this before in our episode on Georges Cuvier. Elephant bones were turning up all over Europe at that time, despite Europe's lack of native elephants. No one knew what a mastodon was quite yet, so the best explanation anyone had was that they must be stray casualties from Rome's war with Hannibal. Plott, however, eventually recognized that the bone he was looking at wasn't quite elephant-like enough to be any kind of large pachyderm. Unable to find any other animals big enough to fit the bill, he decided the bone must be from a race of giant men, as described in the Bible. Which might seem like a stretch, but remember, the biblical interpretation of creation dominated science in those days. And frankly, we've discussed similar misidentifications of prehistoric remains as mythical beasts on the show before, like the griffin or the cyclops, both of which hail from pre-Christian civilizations. Robert Plott's fossil femur has been lost to time. But we know it came from a dinosaur, because he painstakingly preserved its appearance in illustrated form. Decades later, in the mid-1700s, a naturalist named Richard Brooks happened upon Plott's work. When he observed Plott's renderings of the giant man's remains, he saw something quite different from his predecessor. Based on the shape of the femur's end, and maybe because this was before we fully understood which body parts can get fossilized and which can't, Brooks thought the remains resembled a petrified pair of massive testicles. He named the creature accordingly, calling it Scrotum Humanum. Of course, you're probably thinking you've never heard of such a dinosaur, and that's because, fortunately, the story doesn't end there. In 1815, a man named John Kidd found a set of large fossil bones in the very same quarry that Scrotum Humanum had come out of. This time, though, there were enough remains that Kidd recognized that this was no giant man, but instead some kind of giant tetrapod animal. His claim caught the attention of geologist William Buckland. Buckland's name might ring a bell to you listeners. He was a friend to Mary Anning and the guy who got her a government stipend to hunt fossils after she lost everything. Buckland was a bit of a strange bird. He owned a pet bear that he liked to dress up in academic robes. And he was a carnivore through and through. He had a penchant for eating every kind of animal he could get his hands on, from big cats to insects. In his words, the mole and the blue fly were the worst tasting animals in existence. When he was a child, his father had worked in road pavement and improvement, which often unearthed fossil shells like ammonites. This inspired his fondness for Mary Anning and her work later on. While it was Anning who discovered fossilized poop in the stomachs of ichthyosaurs, it was Buckland who coined the term coprolites, and he was so enamored with coprolites that he had a dinner table crafted with coprolites embedded in its surface. At dinner, he'd wait for guests to begin eating before springing the news that they were eating on a table built out of prehistoric poops. The writer and theologian Richard Whatley once wrote of him, "Where shall we our great professor inter that in peace may rest his bones? If we hew him a rocky sepulcher, he'll rise and break the stones and examine each stratum that lies around, for he's quite in his element underground." As if to prove that point, upon his death, Buckland picked a plot of land to be buried in that turned out to be Jurassic limestone. His loved ones had to use explosives just to get him in the ground. But more importantly, he started out as the Reverend William Buckland before becoming a fellow of the Royal Geological Society, and he was always looking to merge the lessons that fossils offered about the past with his faith. Though he initially began as a firm believer in the Great Flood, he later subscribed to gap theory, the idea that there was an indeterminate amount of time before Noah built the ark, during which any manner of animals could have come and gone. As a geologist, he also recognized that the time frame when the floodwaters would have covered the Earth would only compose a fraction of the Earth's strata, and fossil remains in different layers of rock didn't exactly add up with biblical timing. Buckland's blend of lifelong fascination with fossils and progressive interpretation of scripture would make him the ideal candidate to describe the first dinosaur, though he didn't quite know it yet. It wasn't until 1818, when he received a visit from Georges Cuvier, that the puzzle started to form a picture. Cuvier had come off of his work with Mosasaurus, which he had determined to be a very big, very distant relative of monitor lizards that had adapted for life in the ancient oceans. After getting a glimpse of Buckland's mystery bones, Cuvier suggested that Buckland probably had something similar. Buckland, along with a colleague named James Coneybear, set out to describe their reptile for official publication in a joint paper also describing Cuvier's Mosasaurus. The two men didn't exactly try to connect the bones in the most anatomically sound way, though. It's as if they weren't going off of which pieces fit where, possibly because they were influenced by the expectation that they had some kind of giant lizard, like the Mosasaurus. Whatever the reason, the animal they assembled looked nothing like a dinosaur. Buckland and Coneybear imagined their creature as an 8-foot-tall lizard spanning 40 feet from head to tail. From the shape of the femur, they realized that this creature's legs would have to be arranged in an upright, elephantine fashion, rather than in that sort of sprawling, tummy-dragging posture common to reptiles. And based on the size and sharp teeth, and perhaps that Mosasaurus monitor lizard connection, they figured the beast for an amphibious predator capable of hunting on land and in the water. Somewhere along the line, once the men had become pretty certain that the remains were a great lizard and not testicles, Coneybear took to calling the creature Megalosaurus, which means great lizard. The science duo had everything they needed to publish their joint paper. But like I mentioned before, Buckland was always looking for ways to use fossil evidence to support his worldview and vice versa. In 1818, he'd only just become a member of the Royal Geological Society. This was still years before his friendship with Mary Anning, before the coprolites, before the prehistoric creatures that would have him rethinking his ideas about the Great Flood. Buckland was having a difficult time reconciling Megalosaurus with biblical creation, and he didn't want to publish without some kind of explanation for how all these ancient monsters could have happened. A year went by, then two, then three. Cuvier eventually rage quit the joint effort and just published his own description of the Mosasaurus in 1821. Buckland's colleagues became increasingly frustrated with his procrastination. News of Megalosaurus started slipping through the cracks. In 1822, for example, a physician named James Parkinson announced that an enormous reptile had been discovered, even using the name Megalosaurus in his account. Since it was more of a press release than an official description in a scientific journal, he wasn't afforded credit for the animal. Still, the pressure was on to be the first to officially describe what was evidently some new type of animal the world had never seen before. Especially because in the intervening years Buckland and his team spent trying to describe Megalosaurus, more reptiles had turned up, and it was only a matter of time before other naturalists got their own papers out there. Let's backtrack a bit. About the time that Buckland got hold of his Megalosaurus remains, a physician by the name of Dr. Gideon Mantell was paying a visit to a patient in southern England. While he was treating that patient, his wife noticed something strange embedded in one of the stones on the property. A giant tooth. Mantell wasn't a half-bad naturalist. He thought the tooth looked reptilian, but of course, it'd have to belong to something larger than any reptile known to man. Still, he pursued his hunch, and he snagged that tooth so that he could compare it against some reptiles that were known to man. He found a pretty close match in a tiny herbivorous iguana, and guessed that whatever this thing was, it must be some sort of humongous plant-eating reptile. He dubbed his find Iguanodon, meaning iguana tooth. Mantell later returned to the quarry looking for more clues to the beast's identity. And he lucked out when he found a partial skeleton in a chunk of rock that had been churned up by roadwork. Springboarding out of his impression that Iguanodon was probably a big iguana, he arranged his skeleton to look like a large, straight-legged lizard, much like Buckland and Coney Bear's Megalosaurus. Mantell found a spiked protrusion in the set of bones, which he placed on the snout of the creature rhinoceros style. Now, today, we know that Iguanodon is actually a predecessor to the duck-billed hadrosaurs. That spike Mantell put on the nose is actually located where the thumb would be on the animal. Though, whether it's for defense or Fonzie-style thumbs-ups is anyone's guess. Given that Mantell drew from living animal morphology, though, his Iguanodon was an admirable effort for a man discovering a creature with no living analogs. William Buckland had actually challenged Mantell's notion that the teeth he discovered could belong to a large iguana-like reptile, sparking a small rivalry that started to look foolish as more and more of these beasts began rising out of the soil. Soon, it appeared that Mantell's Iguanodon was actually going to beat Buckland's Megalosaurus to publication if Buckland kept sitting on his description pondering its existence. Buckland finally bit the bullet and published his description of Megalosaurus through the Geological Society of London in 1824, in a paper titled Notice on the Megalosaurus or Great Fossil Lizard of Stonesfield, just a hair ahead of Mantell's Iguanodon. But if you're thinking this turned into a Bone Wars scale conflict, you'll be glad to know that not all famous paleontologists conduct themselves with the quote-unquote professionalism of O.C. Marsh and E.D. Cope. Buckland and Mantell were actually super cool about it, with Iguanodon-level thumbs-ups all around. In fact, Mantell would later submit Megalosaurus bucklandi as the species name for Megalosaurus in homage to Buckland, and we've been calling it that ever since. Dr. Mantell would later go on to discover another dinosaur in 1832, an ankylosaurid called Hylaeosaurus, meaning forest lizard. You know Ankylosaurus, the armored dinosaur with the club at the end of its tail? Hylaeosaurus is like that, minus the club. But with its natural suit of armor, Hylaeosaurus demonstrated the diversity of adaptations these lizard monsters were capable of, and that presented a bit of a problem. See, there were more and more of them turning up all the time, but science still didn't know what they were or what to call them. By 1842, it was high time to give these creatures a name. Famed paleontologist Richard Owen grouped Megalosaurus, Iguanodon, and Hylaeosaurus together under the classification Dinosauria, meaning terrible lizards. The dinosaurs had arrived, and their impact on the world was nothing short of meteoric. But it was still a long road from Owen coining the term dinosaur to the image of dinosaurs that we're familiar with today. After naming arguably the coolest group of animals ever to go extinct, Richard Owen oversaw the creation of life-sized models of the known dinosaurs for the Crystal Palace in England. And the sculptures are still there, though wildly inaccurate by modern standards. For example, Megalosaurus is modeled as something of a long-legged, hunchbacked crocodile, and Iguanodon sports that infamous rhinoceros-like horn. Though there are a few that they got right, for example, sculptures of Mary Anning's ichthyosaurs and a few of the extinct mammals. Most of these sculptures are unrecognizable as their namesakes now, but it was clear, even at these early attempts to depict dinosaurs, that in life, they must have been masters of the land, sea, and sky. The sculptures were an eye-opener for the public and the scientific community alike. The first real indication that there was something larger than life hidden beneath the Earth's surface. Right from the start, debates raged over dinosaur form and function. For example, naturalists of the era were often men of heavy faith, much like Buckland himself. The observant Christians among them believed that pain and suffering could only come from original sin. They argued that it made no sense that an ancient carnivore predated human civilization, because predators inflict pain. That meant Megalosaurus had to be an herbivore. Buckland, however, was adamant that Megalosaurus was a carnivore, and he reasoned that it existed to prey on the sick and weak animals of its day, helping other animals by ending their suffering, and thereby still serving a divine function. Such has been the ebb and flow ever since. Ideas about dinosaur behavior and appearance leap forward in bursts. It was another 20 years before it occurred to anyone that some dinosaurs walked on two legs rather than four. The 1859 discovery of Compsognathus, a chicken-sized dinosaur that got screen time as a swarming opportunist in the Lost World Jurassic Park, helped push that idea to the forefront, though our old friend Iguanodon lent a hand too. In 1882, a mostly complete Iguanodon skeleton from Belgium found its way into the hands of paleontologist Louis Dolo, who used his knowledge of anatomy to reconstruct the dinosaur, and he pretty much nailed it, even putting the spike on the thumb where it belonged. Once assembled, he thought the limb sizes were all wrong for the sort of pachyderm posture used in the Crystal Palace models. Dolo instead opted for the tripod position that would dominate dinosaur imagery for a century to come. Two legs, tail dragging on the ground. Iguanodon wasn't the first dinosaur to be positioned this way. Joseph Leidy took this approach with the Hadrosaurus mount that helped trigger the Bone Wars, after all. But it was the most popular dinosaur to be positioned this way at the time. In fact, we now know it wasn't an accurate positioning, either. When reptiles walk on the ground, they typically leave footprints in the dirt, along with drag marks from their tails. Dinosaur tracks lack these drag marks, which is how we determined that they held their tails perpendicular to the ground for balance. Ironically, now that we understand this, we do think that Iguanodon probably walked on all fours after all, with the ability to shift between biped and quadruped positions. Nonetheless, Iguanodon popularized the archetypal image of the two-legged dinosaur. Speaking of archetypal dinosaurs, Megalosaurus got a similar reassembling around the same time, and it turned out to be your run-of-the-mill theropod. Two legs, long tail, three-fingered hands, sharp teeth. Due to a combination of incomplete skeletal remains and looking like a generic meat eater, Megalosaurus became paleontology's go-to carnivore classification for years. So much so that it's now considered sort of a junk taxon, because if scientists weren't sure what dinosaur they had fossils of, they just called it Megalosaurus. At one point, it actually had over 50 described variations. We're still untangling Megalosaurus taxonomy to this day, causing this OG to fall out of favor since its heyday. With the discovery of bigger and cooler dinosaurs, Megalosaurus has been largely forgotten. Gone are the days when it struck terror into the hearts and imaginations of the general public. That spotlight now belongs to the likes of the Tyrannosaurus and the Raptors. But we can't forget that Megalosaurus taught us valuable lessons about what dinosaurs could and should look like. The sculptures on display at the Crystal Palace are a stark reminder that ideas, like life on Earth, are always evolving. Perhaps we should be like the Reverend William Buckland, willing to accept new information and adjust our worldview accordingly. After all, even the mighty Tyrannosaurus has shed its lizard-like visage for more of a birds-with-teeth aesthetic of late. Megalosaurus was the first of its kind, the blueprint for all the theropod carnivores we love so much, and that's not so bad, especially for a dinosaur whose name almost meant nutsack. The theme song for Museum of Natural Mystery was created by Michael Guy Bowman. For more of his work, check out bowman.bandcamp.com. Museum of Natural Mystery is also part of the Palmcast Network, so check out Pomegranate Magazine for more from me. If you're just joining us for the first time here at the outset of Season 2, I always do a blog post to accompany every episode where we take a closer look at some of the things we talked about. So in this case, I'm going to have some pictures of those Crystal Palace sculptures that I mentioned are still standing today. We'll also take a look at the dinosaurs we talked about, you know, Iguanodon, Megalosaurus. What did they look like when people first imagined them, and what do we think they look like today, you know, in the modern era, with a century and a half or so of science behind it. So check out pommag.com, pomemag.com, and you can also find more from me on Twitter at @natmysterycast, or you can email me questions, requests, topic ideas for the future at natmysterypodcast@gmail.com. Museum of Natural Mystery is also on SoundCloud and on iTunes, so subscribe to get the latest episodes as they happen, and hey, if you missed Season 1, it's all there for you. There might have been a couple of names I dropped today, like Mary Anning and Georges Cuvier. I've got entire episodes about those individuals in Season 1, so, you know, go get caught up. If you like the show, maybe leave us a review. It helps other listeners, maybe folks out there who want to know what the first dinosaur to be called a dinosaur was, find the show. Now, I'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode for you. But until then, I'm Emery Cool Katz. Thanks for listening. And hey, it's good to be back.